This chapter is titled The Great Sin. If you've read ahead, you're cheating and you're not allowed to answer. But if you haven't read ahead, what might you guess is the great sin? What is, in Lewis's estimation, the greatest, worstestest sin a person can commit according to Christian thought? We're guessing. Rejection of Jesus Christ? That's a pretty good answer. You're wrong, but it's a good answer. Yeah. Blasphemy is where I got into trouble last time. It's not Lewis's answer, but I had somebody that said, well, blasphemy of the Holy Spirit got to be the worst one, right? And I said, well, it's a complicated topic and it comes with a stiff penalty, but it's not what Lewis has in mind, actually. Yeah. It's the sin that leads to all other sins, is his view. You heard me ranting on it this afternoon. You cheated. You got the pre-sermon. Yes, the answer is pride. Pride is that part of Christian morals where they differ most sharply from all other morals. He's persuaded that pride is the sin that leads you to every other kind of sin by making you think something about yourself you're not supposed to think. And it makes you think that you can blaspheme or disbelieve or be greedy or be, right, it allows you to do all the other things. So there might be sins with tougher penalties in the Bible and are maybe more noticeable, but as far as what is the farthest reaching sin, the greatest and deepest, he says it's pride. Pride is kind of difficult to discuss and it's hard to define. I thought I was going to have a good handle on it, then I started on my lesson and realized it was tough, especially in a culture that is really infatuated with the term self-esteem, that there is a certain amount of good esteem you're supposed to have for yourself. It's really hard to distinguish that from what we mean by pride in a particular way. And that's not even a new problem. I went back, I'm an Aristotle fan. I think Aristotle and Jesus fix all your problems, not in that order. Jesus comes first, but then quickly thereafter, read some Aristotle. And I was surprised that Aristotle didn't say what I thought he would say. Here's my Aristotle quote. Pride then seems to be the sort of crown of the virtues, not a vice. He says pride is the best virtue. Such then is the proud man. The man who falls short of him is unduly humble, and the man who goes beyond him is vain. He says pride is actually the best state you could be in because it means you're a good person and you're aware of it. So in his system, remember there's always the too little, just right, too much when you're talking about virtues and vices. So for Aristotle, pride is the thing you're supposed to have. You don't want to be vain. That's too much pride. But if you have too little, there's this other thing. He said, yeah, you're just too humble. You just sound silly. Saying you can't do things that you actually can. Or saying you're a liar when you actually tell the truth, right? You're just saying bad things about yourself, and that's silly. So for him, that's his point of view, which doesn't sound like the Christian point of view at all. Now we're going to end up arguing about words before we're done, about what which ones means which. But that's was interesting to me to have him say, yeah, pride's the best thing you could have. And Lewis to say, that's the worst thing you could have. And quite often they're on the same page. In modern usage, what does the word pride mean? We use it in a lot of different contexts. And I'm really excited for people to walk in right as this slide's on the screen and they just turn around and walk back out and say, what is going on in there? Yeah. What's going on, ma'am? Yep. I picked these two not to make a political statement for what it's worth, or even a moral statement, but I'm going to stereotype for just a minute. One of these you might associate with one end of the political spectrum and one with the other end of the political spectrum. Both of them are proud of something and use the word pride in a positive way. Isn't that interesting? So in talking about pride, right? That group might say, I'm not proud of my country and what it's been, but I am proud of my identity as LGBTQIA. Okay. And this group would say, I'm not proud of what my country is becoming, but I'm really proud of what it's been. Right. So again, politics on both sides. I'm not picking a side tonight, not my job. But my point is, did you notice that both renditions use the word pride in a very positive way? when in theory, Christians say, pride goeth before the fall. Like, pride's supposed to be a bad thing. And yet we can't, in our modern language, can't stop saying how proud we are of something. Whether it's my sexual identity or my country or whatever, I'm proud of my town or my school or my community or whatever. We just use proud in a really positive way. And so that's part of the trouble. And even Lewis, remember, he's 80 years ago, the word pride already was taking on meanings that were difficult for him to kind of parse out. And we're going to be a little bit further down the road where pride just means so much. There's a lot to see. In Christian usage, when I tried to make my little chart of like too much, too little, just right, I ended up with, I know humility is supposed to be in the middle, right? Be humble has got to be the right thing. And that means pride has got to be the bad thing. But now I don't have a word for this anymore. What is the word in English for being excessively humble? Self-deprecating? Asceticism, maybe? Self-denying? Like, it's going to be a $10 word. Like, we don't have an easy word. Humble, proud. That one's not obvious. We have to kind of like go hunting for a word. And have you ever heard a sermon on being too humble? Is that a problem any of you have? I'm betting not. So it's interesting that we struggle with this. Before we're done tonight, I'm going to fix the chart, I think. I think we follow Lewis to the end, we'll get there. But this is kind of our problem, is we're stuck between this one that only kind of makes sense, this one where pride is the best possible thing, along with Aristotle, who's like, yeah, just don't be vain about your pride. It's a word problem. Okay. Too humble to admit it. I really feel like all of you should be more humble like I am, and then you'd be all right. Okay. What is pride and what makes it such a killer? Lewis starts out with these comments. He says, first of all, everybody has it. Everyone hates it in others, like without mercy. I can forgive murder quicker than I can forgive somebody who's just full of themselves all the time. You put your teeth on edge, it makes you cringe. A proud person just makes you cranky to be around. And so when I see it in you, oh, I just can't stand it. And it's one of the most common descriptors when someone doesn't like somebody else. He's just full of himself. They don't say proud necessarily, but that's what they mean. Everyone denies it in themselves, even though, point one, everyone has it. No one, and he includes Christians in this, he says very few Christians, and basically nobody else, walk around saying, you know, I've got a pride problem. You know, I'd sooner say I'm addicted to something than to say my ego's the size of Montana, right? That is a great ringtone. I like that. And then finally, the more we have of it, the more we dislike it in others. Pride is inherently competitive. So the more you got, the more it aggravates you that somebody else has got it. Sir?
But at the same time, we often don't see it as serious as we see other things.
Right.
I think a few years ago, Mark Driscoll, who got kicked out for
problems of pride. What did he really do? Yeah. Because it doesn't have the obvious ramifications of like sexual immorality, murder, violence, right? It doesn't have the obvious ramifications. It's easy to put it down in on the small, medium, and large scale of French fries. It's got to be one of the small fries. But Lewis says, no, it's the biggest of all because it feeds all the obvious stuff. Driscoll's a good example on several levels. He says, according to Christian teachers, the essential vice, the most evil, is pride. Unchastity, anger, greed, drunkenness, all that, mere flea bites in comparison. Right? They're just a nuisance that's a result of the main attraction. And then he explains, it was through pride that the devil became the devil. Pride leads to every other vice. It is the complete anti-God state of mind. Fascinating. Now I have to pause and take a sip of coffee while I think about how to say this next part. What does he mean? Pride is how the devil became the devil. So yeah, coincidentally, I'm about next week to start teaching Isaiah to some Ukrainian students online. Long story, very fascinating. I'll tell more of it later. But I just did my notes again on the King of Tyre section and the Lucifer fell from the sky. And like the verses on either side say, we're talking about the King of Babylon. But we pick out that one verse and say, that one's about Satan. Just kind of fascinating. So the idea is that Satan must be a fallen angel. And then you say, why did he fall? He must have fallen because of pride. Because I mean, what other kind of trouble could you get into in heaven? He made himself as to be God. And that, well, most of it comes from Milton, actually. Paradise Lost. Better to rule in hell than to serve in heaven. That's not in the Bible anywhere. That's Milton's Paradise Lost. But that account, which is not precisely biblical, but is the most common traditional Christian account of where the devil comes from, is that it comes through pride that he fell. Fun thing in my life is I've kind of gone full circle, decided that the idea that Satan was fallen angel is completely unbiblical, and tried to replace it with something else, couldn't find anything else, and came back to this one. So I'm back on the, yeah, probably that. But I also admit it has nothing to do with anything in the Bible. It's just I haven't got a better story. It's either that or there's like one of those horned toads that went through some ooze in a sewer and mutated into, I don't know. There's not a lot of options for where Satan come from if he's not a fallen angel. So, but Lewis, doing mere Christianity, doesn't feel like he has to explain it. He can just say, hey, most Christians kind of believe this, that Satan was all right until he got full of himself, competed in his mind with God, and decided it was better to be a ruler in hell than a servant of God in heaven, that it was pride that made the devil the devil. That's what he's trying to reference there. And again, I more or less buy that. Even though I can't think of a lot in the Bible that says that. There's one line in Matthew 24. Nope, not going there tonight. Not going to do that. Move on. What does the Bible say about pride? Actually, quite a lot. Okay. Pride, this lesson in particular, ties in closely with the lesson 3 weeks ago that I taught on a Sunday on the glory of God, that God as himself is owed that recognition of who he is, and that we mostly just try to pretend to be that. That's a pretty good definition of pride. Isaiah 57:15, for thus says the one who is high and lifted up, who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy, I dwell on the high and holy place, and also with him who is of a contrite and lowly spirit, to revive the spirit of the lowly, to revive the heart of the contrite. Who is God? God's the one who is high and lofty. And where does he live? In the highest, loftiest place, right? That's fitting. That's appropriate. If you'd like to be with him, I should be high and lofty too? No. You need to know who you are. God knows who he is. You need to know who you are. You need to be lowly and contrite. When you're lowly and contrite, when you are what you are, then you can be with God. He says, I'm pleased to dwell with you. See the strange contradiction that in our mind, if I'm really good, then I can climb the mountain and be with God. God says, well, you can't be me. You have to be you. I made you to be you. So when you're lowly and contrite, then you can be with me. You are what you are, and I am what I am. Does that make any sense at all? Lots of pronouns in there. So Psalm 10, 1 through 4 can say, why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourselves in times of trouble? In arrogance, the wicked hotly pursue the poor. Let them be caught in the schemes that they have devised. For the wicked boasts of the desires of his soul, and the one greedy for gain curses and renounces the Lord. In the pride of his face, the wicked does not seek him. All his thoughts are, there is no God. So he describes all the various things that wicked people can do, and he keeps attributing them to arrogance, boasts, so forth, in his pride, right? What gives rise to all our evil? It's this idea that I don't need God. In fact, I'm not even sure he's there. I just need me. So I'm not seeing God for who he is, so I can be him instead. And all the evil comes out of that point of view. By comparison, consider Jesus, who was and is the high and lofty one who inhabits the high and lofty place. What's the Bible say of him? Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interest, but also to the interest of others. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, high and lofty one who inhabits the heavens, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. The Son is God, and in every sense worthy of that. How did he behave himself when he became one of us? Well, he acted like one of us should act. God being God is exactly how God should act. Jesus being human is exactly how we are supposed to act. I think a lot of us want to act as though we are God, and the gospel did the opposite. God acted as though he were us, so we would know what we're supposed to do. So Ben's definitions, and I even threw in a typo so that you would know that I didn't suffer from pride, because I had the slide all done and then 2 seconds ago found it and I was like, well, I can't fix it now, so I fixed it. Pride is how a human acts when he thinks he is God. Humility is how God acts when he is human. And Jesus is the perfect definition of humility. When God became one of us, he was defined by humility. We do the reverse. We're not God, but we sure try to act like him. Make any sense at all? Okay. So, New Testament then, Jesus can say things like, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Why is that? Because the greatest thing a person could be, a human could be, is humble. It's the most appropriate thing you could be. It's not the most appropriate thing God could be. If the creator of the universe said, oh, shucks, I guess I'm not much, that would be weird. It would be inappropriate for him to pretend he's not the creator of the universe. See the difference? But for us, the greatest quality a human could have would be to be childlike, because we are the children of our Father. Or to quote James 4:6, that he gives more grace, therefore it says, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Okay, so where does pride lead, and why do we think it leads to so much trouble? Back to Lewis now. He says, pride is forever associated with competitiveness. And one trip to a Little League game will convince you of this forever and ever. Okay. I didn't have to look hard for a picture on the internet. Every person's pride is in competition with everybody else's. When you say, I'm the best, what you're actually saying is, I am better than, yeah, fill in the blank. Who? Well, everybody, obviously. You. The real reason we resent other people getting attention is that we want it, is Lewis's sentiment. And it's really hard to be happy for other people being celebrated because we want to be celebrated. Pride is competitive. See the difference? He's not just saying, in theory, two people could live side by side and both be greedy. We'll get to greed in a minute. And as long as both of them are outrageously, exorbitantly rich and get their money somewhere else, rich people can even get along with each other in that sense. Two proud people can't, because you'll always be in competition. There is no contentment. There is no satisfaction. And in fact, Lewis says, it's kind of what leads to greed. Pride doesn't just want something, it wants more of it. It leads to greed because it is never satisfied. It drives us to seek things not out of need or even want, but to appear superior. Most of the things, in the metal now, everybody ready? You got your steel-toed boots on? Okay. Most of the things you own, you do not own for survival purposes. Very few things do you own because if you didn't own them, you would die. The vast majority of things you own have something to do with either comfort, pleasure, or, if Lewis is right, the satisfaction of owning them and being that great to have owned it, to be competitive with somebody else. So that's why he says pride, that's where all our trouble comes from. He says the Christians are right. It is pride which has been the chief cause of misery in every nation and every family since the world began. It's the root of all the problems. So he's pretty insistent on that. Why is it such a problem, and why do Christians recognize it? Here's why. In God, you come up against something which is in every respect immeasurably superior to yourself. As long as you are proud, you cannot know God. That's why Christians rank pride higher, because we, in theory, should notice it more. See, if you don't believe in God, and we're just comparing ourselves to other people, maybe pride is, you know, one of the things you shouldn't do, bad manners. But if the first premise of your faith and religion is, there is a being greater than me, then the first sin of your religion has to be denying that and pretending it's me. Like if you want to know God at all, you have to get smaller, because he's larger. The first principle of Christian faith is coming to know God, and Lewis says you can't do that with pride. So Christians keep pointing to it and say, that's got to go, that's got to go. For pride is spiritual cancer. It eats up the very possibility of love or contentment or even common sense. You can't love anybody. What is love? 1 Corinthians 13 says love does not boast. Love is esteeming somebody else more valuable than yourself and putting their interest above yourself. If you're proud, by definition, you cannot love. If you're proud, you can't be content, because there might be somebody out there who has more stuff than you, and you're not content until you're better than everybody else. Newsflash, there's always somebody who's got more or is more or does more than you. And even common sense. Pride will make a very clever person do very stupid things in order to make themselves feel superior. But in every other context, they know the right answer until they're in the equation. So it undermines every other value we have. He wants to talk about four misconceptions we have about pride and humility. It's pretty good. One, he says, pleasure at being praised is not pride. This finally we get now to what do you mean by pride, and he's going to start chipping away at it a little bit. He says if you did something right and somebody says good job, that's supposed to feel good. How do I know that? Because God does that to us. In the parable of the talents, one of the men goes and takes his five talents and makes five talent more, and what is he told? Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little, I'll set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. Like he praises his servant. And Jesus says this is kind of a picture of God in response to us. Does God say, well done to us? Not in a, wow, you're really morally superior kind of way. You never hear God saying, wow, you didn't sin after all. You guys are great. Never happens. Okay. But when his servants act like servants, he does say, well done, good job. That's what you're supposed to do. And that's supposed to make you feel good. When, you know, we talk about daddy issues or mommy issues, a lot of that stems from what? Whether or not your parents made you to feel the appreciation of being their kid. You know, it's a lot of it. It's a real thing. It affects you for the rest of your life. Okay? Because we're meant to find a certain amount of satisfaction in having that person higher up the ladder from us say, that's what you're supposed to do. Good job. Lewis says, I don't think that's pride in and of itself. Okay, fair point. He says, genuine admiration for another person is not necessarily pride. Pride is usually the thing you direct at yourself. So, do you see a fundamental difference between saying, I'm very proud of myself, or I'm proud of Lucas? There's at least some difference in those two sentences and what we mean by it. Now let me do this and just show you how slippery it is. I'm really proud of the job I've done raising Lucas. See, that one got back around to me, even though I pointed it at him. So it's really slippery. But his point is, feeling genuine admiration for another person and saying, hey, that person's doing well. Even somebody that's not your kid, someone higher up. That person's a role model. I appreciate them. He says, you're supposed to notice that. That also is good. Very often in such sentences, he says, the phrase is proud of means have a warm-hearted admiration for. Such an admiration is, of course, very far from being a sin. It's kind of how you're supposed to feel about good people. So Paul will say, mark those that so walk so that you have an example. And follow me even as I follow Christ. Like you see somebody doing right, you're supposed to say, I admire that. And he says, I don't think that's the dangerous pride we're talking about either. 2 Corinthians 9, listen to Paul talk about it. Now it is superfluous for me to write to you about the ministry for the saints, for I know your readiness, of which I boast. Oh, Paul's bragging. I boast about you to the people of Macedonia, saying that Achaia has been ready since last year, and your zeal has stirred up most of them. But I am sending the brothers so that our boasting about you may not prove empty in this matter. You may be ready, as I said you would be. So he's been taking collection, and he goes to a church, and they're not ready to give. He says, boy, Corinthians are ready. They've been ready since last year. And he brags on them to the other church. And then he says, I'll live up to it, right? Which is a great bit of ministry. But anyway, the idea that what kind of boasting is this? It's not, well, I'm such a great apostle that you turned out to be good Christians. He says, no, I genuinely appreciate your generosity. And so I point you out to people and say, you should notice this fellow, this church. Okay. 2 Thessalonians, Paul actually does this a lot. We ought always to give thanks to God for you, brothers, as is right, because your faith is growing abundantly, and the love of every one of you for another is increasing. Therefore, we ourselves boast about you in the churches of God for your steadfastness and faith and all your persecutions and the afflictions that you're enduring. So I guess my point, and Lewis's, is there does seem to be a difference between saying, if me saying Eric's a great guy, and Eric saying, I sure am. We can recognize intuitively, one of those is a bad thing, one of those is probably good. Let's do the difference. So I think it's slippery. I'll give you that. One can lead to the other. You can fall in love with people telling you how great you are. Okay. But there does seem to be at least some difference. I think that's good to know. Number three caught my attention. God doesn't want to rid us of pride for his own sake, but ours. And I put a question mark on that slide, because I just preached on a topic related to that, and I had questions. It was another one of those paragraphs, Sky, where I started off disagreeing with Lewis and then read to the end and said, well, okay, maybe I agree. It was a little tricky. What I think Lewis is trying to say is, this isn't God being a tyrant who is threatened by your independence, and he's got to keep his thumb on you, or you might overthrow him. If anything, that's to get back to that Satan story. Like that's the idea of, he's just a tyrant, he's keeping me down so I don't become all I could be. That is, it's actually God in his proper place and you in your proper place that he's looking for. He says, we must not think pride is something God forbids because he is offended at it, or that humility is something he demands as due to his own dignity, as if God himself was proud. He is not in the least worried about his dignity. Those sentences troubled me. I think I know what he's trying to say, but let me compare it to Isaiah, of course, because I'm studying Isaiah right now. For my own sake, I do it, for how should my name be profaned? My glory I will not give to another. Kind of sounds like he's doing it for his own sake. There is some sense in which God is saying, not that he needs our recognition, but that it is fitting for him to be God and us to be us. And it is unfitting, in this context, for an idol to be treated like God. Now, is he worried that the idol is going to accidentally become God and overthrow him out of the heavens? No. Is he worried? Is he offended? I think in the sense of, that's absurd. Is he offended in the sense of, that wounded me? I'm less God now because you didn't say it. Is it, uh, is it Tinkerbell that you have to clap? And if you really believe really hard, Tinkerbell comes back to life. Is this, am I in the right Peter Pan world? Is that right? Okay. Oh, okay, Peter Pan, Tinkerbell dies, and then to bring her back, she drinks the poison. And to bring her back to life, you have to clap and believe really hard. And that's not who God is, that if you worship him really hard and say, I really believe in God, then he gets to be God. And if you say, well, I'm not so sure, he slumps over and says, oh, I'm wounded. Okay, let's skip Tinkerbell. Let's go to, hang on, no, I got another one. Christmas movies where believing in Santa makes the sled fly. Okay, there's enough of those. The sled runs on people's imagination and Christmas faith, right? And if you don't believe, Santa falls out of the sky. Again, not the way God works. If the whole world said, nah, he's not so great, he's still great, he is unwounded, is he offended in the sense of, what's wrong with you people? Yeah, a little bit, I think. And that's kind of what that passage says to me. So I think God does view himself as great because he is. And the funny thing, he doesn't view himself as the greatest God. It's not like there's a cousin God that he's trying to impress, right? He and he alone is God. There's no competition. His competition is a fictional person named Zeus that we made up one day. He's not really worried about that. If you came up to me and, this is a terrible analogy, but I'm just sticking with it, okay? You came up to me and said, Ben, you're not the greatest preacher at our church. I said, really? No, this guy I drew on this piece of paper while you were preaching, this is the greatest preacher, and you show me a stick figure. I may or may not think I'm the greatest preacher. I'm pretty sure I can beat the stick man, right? And God, whatever he thinks of himself, is not intimidated by our stump of wood that we said is God. So how does he view himself? He knows himself. He is great, period, full stop. He's not greater, he's greatest, period. I think Lewis's point is also correct if understood to mean God does not insist on our humility because he is threatened by our pride. And I think this is Lewis's point. Your pride is bad for you. God will still be as great as he is, whether you believe in him or not. But when you're proud, it hurts you. And that's the point I think he's trying to get at. I just troubled by the wording a little bit because of that verse in Isaiah. So he says, the point is, he wants you to know him, wants to give you himself. And he and you are two things of such a kind that if you really get into any kind of touch with him, you will, in fact, be humble. Right? You can't actually know God and not recognize, oh, I'm not that. And what kind of humble? Delightedly humble, he says. Feeling the infinite relief of having for once got rid of all the silly nonsense about your own dignity, which has made you restless and unhappy all your life. He says, it's actually deeply liberating. You know, when you try to be God, how'd that go for you? You failed. And how do you feel about your failures? Like a failure. I mean, you feel terrible about it. And so the proud person on the exterior, on the interior, so often deeply insecure and threatened and fragile, and brittle. He says, actually, it's a deep relief to say, I'm a creature. I don't have to be God. I don't have to know everything. I don't have to make the sun rise in the morning. Somebody else has that. Somebody else covers it. My job is to be good at being human, which it turns out is a much lower standard than being God. Still can't live up to it, but I'm getting closer, right? It's just deeply relieving to not have to be God. It's a delight, which I totally agree with that. And then number four, misunderstanding, he says, true humility is not self-deprecation. There you go. The word was coming up. It is interest in others more than self. And that was the way Paul said it in Philippians 2. Let each esteem other better than himself. That it was a concern. Look not to the affairs of self, but to others. It's about attention, which leads to possibly, and this is going to be hard for me because I like every page of Lewis, possibly my favorite part of all of Lewis' lore and wonder is when he explains what humility really is. And kind of clicks in my head, the key turns, the lock opens. He says, in Christianity, humility is the good thing, but it's not about pride and whatever the other is. He says, thinking you're great is a problem, thinking you're trash is the problem. What is humility? The real test of being in the presence of God is that you either forget about yourself altogether or see yourself as a small, dirty object. It's better to forget about yourself altogether. He says, we have trouble. Like, do I think too much or do I think too little? He says, the solution is stop thinking about yourself. That's what humility is. So back to Aristotle for a second. Aristotle says pride is receiving the appropriate praise for your actions, believing it, and enjoying it. Lewis says enjoying praise is not pride at all. Lewis says we almost never have the appropriate opinion of ourselves. So every time you think about yourself, you're always either thinking too much or too little. Because it's really hard to know yourself. God knows himself and God knows you. You don't know you and you don't know God. Lewis says the solution is to just stop thinking about yourself so much, and then you won't be thinking about yourself too much or too little. So, the greatest of all quotes, humility is not thinking less of yourself, it is thinking of yourself less. Because if you play that game of trying to figure out how to have the perfectly right opinion of yourself, you're actually, it's an impossible task, because in the process of having the right opinion of yourself, you're thinking about yourself. It's kind of like sticking your finger in the outlet saying, I wonder if it's hot or not. You're going to find out, and it's not going to matter, right? You're done messed up. The key is just spend less time thinking about yourself. Think about other people. Think about God above all. And you will just be the humble you're supposed to be. And you won't even know it. It'll be great. Humble is something you can't know that you are, because a humble person didn't notice themselves being humble. Huh? Unless you're Moses. Oh, he's meek, totally different. Beyond Lewis, he doesn't spend a lot of time, like the chapter just ends kind of right there. I want to know, how do you develop humility? He has one suggestion. I'm going to go a step further and make four. The first one's pretty good. How do you develop humility? Number one is his. If anyone would like to acquire humility, I think, tell him the first step. First step is to realize that one is proud. If you think you are not conceited, it means you are very conceited indeed. And that's the end of the chapter. Like, if you're thinking about it that much, you're proud. Stop it. Okay. So step one is definitely honest introspection, in the sense of acknowledging my pride and then moving on to other things. Not honest introspection in the sense of I will look deep inside myself at all times, but in the sense of, hey, maybe I think about myself too much. I wonder what option number two is. Option number two, think about God more. The more you dwell on God, the better estimation you'll have of yourself without having thought about yourself at all. So prayer and worship is a great tool. It's really hard to be conceited when you're saying things like, great are you, God, God above all. There are people that pull it off, but it's hard. Service without reward. Do things with the intention of not getting caught. Try that differently. Do good things. If you do bad things, try not to get caught, you're a criminal. Do good things with the intention of not getting caught. That doesn't mean you can't enjoy it when somebody says, good job, Stephen, well done. But you didn't do it for that purpose, and it becomes a little game with you to see how much I can get away with doing good without anybody noticing. Okay. And then seeing what things you can do without. Again, is there a danger there too? Mark mentioned the ascetic. Like, you can become so self-denying that it's dangerous. Absolutely. And it becomes a kind of pride. I can go this long without eating, or I can do without, it can be proud. Okay. But one way to stop competing is to just stop playing the game. If you say, you know, don't need a bigger house, don't need a bigger car, I don't need more stuff. I lost. In the game of competition with the Joneses, I wave the white flag, and I'm just going to be the loser in that. It's a great way to just move on. So those would be my steps if you're looking for concrete things to do that I think help. Okay, all done. Discussion questions, here are mine, and then as always, you can distract me with yours. Number one, did Lewis convince you that pride is the great sin? Why or why not? Anybody want to come back and say, no, it's setting the thermostat wrong, or whatever it is. Number two, can pride ever be a good word? Are we just talking in circles here because we use pride, because we use pride to mean different things? So in your everyday speech now, you've heard my lesson on pride, are you going to stop saying the word pride in a good way? Are you going to say, well, let's take one out. I'll leave off the pride flag for a minute because that's probably too controversial for tonight. How about proud to be an American? Like, how does that sit with you after this lesson? Does it make you queasy or like, well, yeah, of course I am? Or I heard this. I had a guy, not complaining about him, but I'll leave off his name. He would lead prayers and he would quite often say in his prayer, God, help us to hold our heads high and be proud to be Christians. And I always thought it was a funny expression. Like, I knew what he wanted to say, don't be ashamed of your faith. But what he said was, help us to hold our head high and be proud as a Christian. And maybe we're just talking in circles. Maybe he meant what I meant, and the word pride gives me the heebie-jeebies. So anyway, you can tell me what you feel about the word pride. Can you have an unhealthy excess of humility? What would that be called? Self-effacing or self-deprecating or something. Wait. If anybody's got a great word for that, I'm still looking for one. Is it ever dangerous to be proud of someone else? Could that be dangerous? Maybe. And then finally, if you really want to throw down a fun conversation, is God proud? God actually believes he is, in fact, the greatest being in the universe. Is God proud? Okay, that's all I got. If I haven't provoked you enough, then you weren't listening. What questions or thoughts or answers or disclaimers or diversions do you have?